work to suppress and prevent the emergence of other countries on the global scene. However, this strategy has now brought damaging results for the United States, alienating its long-term allies like Saudi Arabia, France, Brazil, and also India.
Positioning itself as greater and superior than the rest of the world, the foreign policy of the United States is being used as a tool to safeguard its global hegemony. The country has been using it to push for global alignment to meet its economic and strategic goals. In the process to secure its gains, the U.S. has been meddling in other countries' domestic affairs, subverting their governance and creating turmoil. Claiming to help the countries through humanitarian intervention, the U.S. has not been able to accept the multipolar reality of the world, where different countries are interconnected to progress in their own ways. The foreign policy establishment of the United States believes that the country is helping other nations to be on the right side of the history by following the much-hyped American values and sharing the economic approach of Washington. However, this belief is proving detrimental for the Indo-U.S. relations, alienating India, a country America has sought partnership with to restrain the growing influence of China in the region. According to foreign policy, despite a shared democratic system and weariness of China, the U.S. and India do not share a similar worldview.
India and the U.S. for decades have held divergent worldviews, pursuing conflicting objectives. The imposing behavior of the U.S., forcing India to toe its line, is further distancing New Delhi from Washington. A recent survey conducted by the U.S.-based business intelligence company Morning Consult shows Indians consider the U.S. as the second greatest military threat to their country after China. It's interesting to mention that Indians also place greater blame on Washington and NATO for the Russia-Ukraine war than on the Russian President Vladimir Putin.
The U.S. belief that the geopolitical and economic tensions between New Delhi and Beijing will lead to closer ties between India and the United States has failed on the ground. There are remarkable differences between the U.S. and India on geopolitical issues and other policies. India, being one of the world's largest economies, supporting a powerful army with a thriving young population, is not ready to accept dictates from a foreign country. New Delhi has been showing that it can be forced to accept the policies of the United States on different geopolitical issues ranging from trade, climate, Russia-Ukraine war, or its relations with its neighbors. According to the result of the study conducted by a U.S.-based company, 60% Indians want their government to continue purchasing the Russian oil, thus showing their disdain against the meddling of the United States in the affairs of their country. The unwanted interference of the United States in the political and foreign affairs of India has made the Indian population perceive that Washington is unable to understand the values and policies of India, and in the process trying to damage the interests of the South Asian nation.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by geopolitical analyst Mr. Sayed Muhammad Ali from Islamabad. First of all, welcome to the program, sir. Now, the U.S. believes that it's leading nations towards the right side of history. So to what extent is this arrogant thinking shaping the foreign policy of the country and proving counterproductive on the ground?
Well, the reality of international politics is this, that we are living in the last days of the post-Second World War Western world order. And when you view the U.S. policy right now towards the world in general and the developing world in particular, you can interpret it as a U.S. attempt to dominate and preserve the status quo by maintaining its disproportionate influence over the world institutions, policies, and countries. Although the recent changes in the world order, the rise of some countries, the revival of some countries, the resurgence of some powers, has complicated the U.S. Pax Americana agenda, which is why I think there new opportunities emerging, new alliances being built, which is making it very difficult for the U.S. to continue to dominate the world the way it did in the last few years.
Mr. Sayed Ali, the friendship with India was an action to contain China's rise in the region. However, it seems Sino-India tensions have not helped the Indo-US relations. So what's your take on this?
I think it was somewhat naive on the part of Washington to expect India to become the pivot of the U.S. Indo-Pacific strategy and in the containment of China project. I think the leading strategic thinkers in the U.S. are beginning to recognize the limits of Indian security commitment towards the U.S. interests. And I think it is also reflected in the recent U.S. Security strategy that it distinguished between alliances and partnerships. And it is very important to notice that the word used for India was not a strategic ally, but a strategic partner. And how the US explains the difference is basically ally is a country which shares not just the interests, but also the values of the US. Whereas a strategic partner like India is a country with which the U.S. expects some common interests but do not share the values with it.
Sir, Indians regard the U.S. as the second largest military threat against their country. How do you view this estrangement of Indians towards the U.S.?
I think it is a very important issue which is often ignored in international politics. That the Indian strategic thinking is characterized by three key features. Number one, hatred towards the Muslim minorities. Number two, distrust towards the Western powers. And number three, to maintain its strategic autonomy, which means that it should not commit itself with any major power completely. So these are the three key features of the Indian strategic character. So if you see that when India tested its first nuclear weapon, which it ironically described as Smiling Buddha in 1974, it was not aimed against China, because China built its nuclear weapons more than a decade ago, and they had not any major conflict in the 70s. But it was the Indira Doctrine, which was very similar to the US Monroe Doctrine, in which the Indian strategic elite and the political leadership saw Indian Ocean as an Indian lake, which India should dominate. And it did not want any power, including the US, to restrain or constrain the Indian interests in this region. So that is something which is very interesting. And since the anti-Western perspective is quite deeply rooted in the Indian diplomatic and strategic elite, I think it is very important for the international community to not neglect the deep-rooted Indian thinking that India should be a great power in its own right, and it should not be subordinate to any other power, including its current partner, the United States.
Last but not least, sir, the U.S. is against independent-minded countries, punishing the non-adherent nations to force compliance. So do you think this flawed U.S. policy will distance India further from America?
I think it is a very important issue that the Western powers, particularly the U.S., narrowly interpret its values and the international system. And it is very important for peace, progress, and stability around the world and in different regions for the U.S. to respect and tolerate and understand that diverse value systems, ideologies, political systems, and cultures of different countries and civilizations. Because if different value systems are perceived and interpreted as a threat, and efforts are made to change regimes, to change political ideologies, to interfere in the political system of different countries, then obviously this will not be seen as a favorable, mutually beneficial relationship by most countries. And you can immediately see this is the problem that the U.S. is facing with China, with Russia, with North Korea, with Iran, with so many other countries, that the issue is not their power. The issue is their political system, their ideology and culture. And we have witnessed recently in the U.S. Attack on Afghanistan that they tried to change the culture, the religion, the ideology and way of life of Afghan people, but it did not succeed.
On that note, I would like to thank geopolitical analyst Mr. Sayed Muhammad Ali from Islamabad for being on the program. Thank you, sir. Now, let's see what people around the world had to say.
David Santoro tweeted, I've been in India for nearly a week and I'm more convinced than ever that if the U.S. wants to advance U.S.-Indian relations, it needs to engage India in the same way France does. That is, stop trying to rally India behind you, just focus on areas where cooperation is possible. Ivan Wan wrote, except the U.S. is increasingly pushing India away by pressuring them to cut off ties with Russia. Bharat Now tweeted, India has been very clear regarding its independent foreign policy, even under immense pressure from both blocs, something the U.S. is not used to. India has chosen to serve its own national interests as a true rising power in a brave new multipolar world. Diva says, is the U.S. really helping India grow its economy? We have seen no serious attempt by the U.S. and EU to decouple from China, only talks and lectures. I think the USA will create a conflict and run away. India is not your vassal like Japan and South Korea, where you control foreign policy.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Russia has found a new way to maintain the demand for its oil supply. Despite the recent ban on Russian oil imports, it's continuing to provide Europe with fuel via India. New Delhi has been buying cheap Russian oil and selling it to Europe at a higher price after its refinement. According to a recent report by Russian analytics firm Kepler, India has become Europe's largest supplier of refined fuels this month, while simultaneously buying record amounts of Russian crude oil.
According to the International Energy Agency, Russia is one of the world's largest oil producers and exporters. In the recent years, Europe has heavily relied on Russian oil imports, making up nearly 30% of the continent's total crude oil supply. However, since the Russian-Ukraine conflict in early 2022, the European Union imposed sanctions on Russia, which included a ban on the import of oil transported by sea. The ban was followed by an embargo on the fuel imports from the country. Nevertheless, the European Union sanctions have not prevented countries such as India from purchasing discounted Russian oil. Following the ban, Europe's reliance on Indian crude oil products has grown rapidly. According to Kepler statistics, Europe's imports of refined fuel from India is set to surge to more than 360,000 barrels per day, surpassing imports from Saudi Arabia. Victor Kitona, lead crude analyst at Kepler Energy Analysis Company, said that despite all the sanctions that have been announced, Russian oil has still found its way to Europe. And the increase in fuel exports from India to the West is a good example in this regard. He added that this scenario was inevitable given all the oil that India buys from Russia.
Russia has emerged as a major oil supplier to India for the first time in the 2023 fiscal year. According to the data provided by the Kepler company, the entry of Russian oil shipments to India is expected to surpass 2 million barrels per day, representing almost 44% of New Delhi's overall oil imports. This surge in demand for Russian oil is due to the fact that India has been buying oil at discounted rates from Moscow amid the Western sanctions on the country since the Russia-Ukraine conflict.
According to the data by the Indian Ministry of Commerce and Industry, Russia was the largest exporter of crude oil to India by value in February, in spite of the Western price cap of $60 per barrel. The price cap kept by the Western countries was designed to limit Russian oil revenues while keeping the oil itself flowing to avoid a global price shock. Crude oil imports from Russia to India stood at $3.35 billion in February, followed by Saudi Arabia at $2.30 billion and Iraq at $2.03 billion. According to a Bloomberg report, more than half of Russia's seaborne oil exports went to the European Union and G7 countries before Moscow was imposed with sanctions in the early 2022. However, since the sanctions on Russia, the scenario has changed. Presently, as per Kepler's data, India has become Europe's largest supplier of refined fuels. While the Indian supply of refined fuels has helped meet the EU's demand, its direct flow from Russia has been cut off, ultimately boosting demand for Moscow's oil barrels. This has resulted in higher transportation costs and more competition for European refineries that cannot access cheap Russian oil. This development has come amid wider market scrutiny about the region's diesel imports. This new development has not only challenged Europe's energy policy, but also demonstrated the ever-changing global oil market dynamics.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by strategic expert Lieutenant General Shokin Chauhan from India. First of all, welcome to the program, sir. Now, the energy cooperation between Russia and India is growing. What implications will it have on the global balance of power?
To talk about the global balance of power or the global energy balance of power with India buying Russian oil, we have to take a bit of a view backwards to, the first time that oil was used as a weapon in 1973. And from that time onwards, India has been aware that because she has no access to oil, we have to get and plan access to our own oil in our own way. So actually, all this came to an head in 1998, when you remember that Saudi Arabia decided that she would give oil to Pakistan at lower than normal rates. And India realized that we had to do it on our own, and that's the time when we started investing in oil all over the world. And we have investments in Russia, and because of those investments, we are now have access to cheaper Russian oil, and as a result have been able to get over this oil shock that when the oil giants raised their prices. India was able to prevent these prices being raised in India because they had access to cheaper Russian oil. So it does matter eventually, but India has been able to use this crisis to stand up on her own.
Lieutenant, in light of the increasing demand for Indian refined fuel in Europe, how do you see India's role in shaping the global oil market, and what challenges and opportunities lie ahead for the South Asian country?
You asked about India emerging as a alternative or as a global refining power, because we have access to how this world market moves now is like this, that India has access to cheaper Russian oil that cheaper Russian oil is brought into India and refined. We are one of the world's largest refiners of oil. I think second or third in the world. And with that ability to refine oil, India has been able to utilize this cheap Russian oil, refine it, and resell it to the European market at a higher price. And that has helped the Indian economy. As you know, the Indian population has become the largest in the world. We are a young population. We are growing very, very strongly. We need access to more money. We are developing our infrastructure. So all that requires money. And this ability of India to get this cheaper Russian oil, refine it in India, and resell it at a higher price shall certainly help the Indian economy. Along with this help to the Indian economy, since oil and economics has always been on the world stage as a geopolitical weapon, I would say this is the first time that India is realizing that we have to increase our ability, improve our economy, if we are to have a say in the geopolitics of the world.
Lieutenant, the European Union has put a ban on Russian oil imports. So how has this changed the global oil trade?
You know, Ali Reza, I must take our mind back to the global crisis about Europe's decision to ban Russian oil. So what exactly happened was that when Europe followed the American lead to ban Russian oil, she went through a crisis of the availability of oil and the availability of expensive oil for her citizens. Europe, as you know, is not a growing market anymore. Economically, she is suffering. And this Russia-Ukraine war couldn't have come at a worse time for the European economy. The Indian ability to get cheaper Russian oil came from an ability that we had made a number of excellent financial decisions to invest in the Russian oil infrastructure from 2002 onwards. And because of that, India was able to get Russian oil at almost $10 less than the rest of the world.
Last but not least, how do you see the future of energy trade between Russia, India and Europe? And what factors are likely to shape this trade in the coming years?
That's a very interesting question about the future of the economic trade or the oil trade between India and Russia and how it is affecting Europe's economy. I feel that over the next 2 to 5 years, this will continue. The reason being that I don't think the Russian-Ukraine war is going to end. I don't think that the Americans will lift their sanctions on Russia. And as a result of it, Russia will continue to have to depend upon friends like India to pick up her oil, give her money, and also help her sell her oil to the world, her natural resource. But why do I say only 2 to 5 years? The issue is that over the next decade, the world will move away from the use of fossil fuels, especially to power their transportation. There are, as you know, great strides being taken in the batteries that are being used now to power the transportation all across the world. As the batteries become better and as they have the capability to have more power and to keep that power for a longer period of time, and they become cheaper to use than fossil fuels, the world will automatically shift to the EV kind of vehicles or to any other technology that is available as a domestic resource.
There you have it, strategic expert Lieutenant General Shokin Chauhan from India. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Ben Norton tweeted, "The EU sanctioned Russia and boycotted its oil, yet is still buying it indirectly from India at a higher price. This is ironically fueling both de-dollarization and inflation in the eurozone, where workers' real wages dropped 6.5% from 2020 to 2022. S.L. Canton wrote, "Are these two facts related? India is importing record amounts of oil from Russia. India is exporting record amounts of fuel and diesel to Europe. The irrational U.S. and EU sanctions." Norbert Elikis says, "India is importing crude from Russia and selling to Europe. Guess who's being benefited? India has now become one of the largest suppliers of refined fuel to Europe. Also imported record crude oil from Russia."
And that was our episode about the Indo-US relations and Russian oil finding its way to Europe via India. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In California, United States, a reparations panel has approved a report that could mean billions of dollars for black residents. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. California's Reparations Task Force voted on Saturday, 6th of May, to approve recommendations on how the state may compensate and apologize to black residents for generations of harm caused by discriminatory policies. The nine-member committee, which first convened nearly 2 years ago, gave final approval at a meeting in Oakland, California, to a hefty list of proposals that now go to state lawmakers to consider for reparations legislation. U.S. Representative Barbara Lee, a Democrat from Oakland, who is co-sponsoring a bill in Congress to study restitution proposals for African Americans, at the meeting called on states and the federal government to pass reparations legislation. Reparations are not only morally justifiable, but they have the potential to address long-standing racial disparities and inequalities, Barbara Lee said. The panel's first vote approved a detailed account of historical discrimination against black Californians in areas such as voting, housing, education, disproportionate policing, and incarceration, and others. Other recommendations on the table range from creation of a new agency to approve services to descendants of enslaved people to calculations on what the state owes them in compensation. An apology and an admission of wrongdoing just by itself is not going to be satisfactory, said Chris Lodgson, an organizer with the Coalition for a Just and Equitable California, a reparations advocacy group. An apology crafted by lawmakers must include a censure of the gravest barbarities carried out on behalf of the state, according to the draft recommendation approved by the task force. Those would include a condemnation of former governor Peter Hardman Burnett, the state's first elected governor, and a white supremacist who encouraged laws to exclude black people from California. After California entered the Union in 1850 as a free state, it did not enact any laws to guarantee freedom for all Californians, the draft recommendation notes. On the contrary, the state Supreme Court enforced the Federal Fugitive Slave Act, which allowed for the capture and return of runaway enslaved people until for over a decade, until emancipation. By participating in these horrors, California further perpetuated the harms African Americans faced, imbuing racial prejudice throughout society through segregation, public and private discrimination, and unequal dispersal of state and federal funding, the document says. The task force approved a public apology acknowledging California's responsibility for past wrongdoings and promising the state will not repeat them. It will be issued in the presence of people whose ancestors were enslaved. California has previously apologized for placing Japanese Americans in internment camps during the Second World War and for violence against and mistreatment of Native Americans. The panel also approved a section of the draft report saying reparations should include cash or its equivalent for eligible residents. More than 100 residents and advocates gathered at Mills College of Northeastern University in Oakland, California, a city that is the birthplace of the Black Panther movement. They shared frustrations over the country's broken promise to offer up to 40 acres and a mule to newly freed enslaved people. Many said it is past time for government to repair the harms that have kept African Americans from living without fear of being wrongfully prosecuted, retaining property and building wealth. Elaine Brown, former Black Panther Party chairwoman, urged people to express their frustration through demonstrations. Saturday's task force meeting marked a crucial moment in the long fight for local, state, and federal government to atone for discriminatory policies against African Americans. The proposals are far from implementation, however. There is no way in the world that many of these recommendations are going to get through because of the inflationary impact, said Roy Brooks, a professor and reparations scholar at the University of San Diego School of Law in California. Some estimates from economists have projected that the state could owe upwards of $800 billion, or more than 2.5 times its annual budget, in reparations to African Americans. The figure in the latest draft report released by the task force is far lower, however. The group has not responded to email and phone requests for comment. The Secretary of State, Shirley Weber, a former Democratic Assembly member, authored legislation in 2020 creating the task force with a focus on the state's historical culpability for harm against African Americans, and not as a substitute for any additional reparations that may come from the federal government. Fox News Channel has also covered this story. The state of California's first-in-the-nation reparations task force has voted to approve recommendations for how the state should compensate and apologize to African Americans in response to slavery. The 9-member committee that has been deliberating on the recommendations for 2 years voted in Oakland, California on Saturday, 6th of May. To give its final approval to an extensive report that offers proposals that will then go to the state lawmakers in Sacramento to consider for reparations legislation. The California Task Force recommendations range from creation of a new agency to provide services to descendants of enslaved people to tailored calculations of what the state owes residents for issues like housing discrimination and police brutality. The task force approved a public apology acknowledging the state's responsibility for past wrongdoing and promising the state will not repeat them. It would be issued in the presence of people whose ancestors were enslaved. The committee will meet one more time on 29th of June this year in Sacramento to officially hand over the final report to the state legislature. The task force did not put forward an official price tag, which will be ironed out by the legislature but experts believe the cost could reach into billions of dollars. The report does include projection restitution estimates and suggestions as to who would qualify for these payments. Economists predicted in a preliminary estimate in March that California's reparations plan would cost the state more than $800 billion. The task force, which consulted five economists and policy experts to arrive at the number, said at the time that the total didn't include compensation for property that the group says was taken unjustly or for the devaluation of black-owned businesses. California's total annual state budget sits at roughly $300 billion. Earlier this week, however, the task force published its latest proposals, which don't contain an overall price tag, but instead outline ways California could calculate how much money black residents have lost since 1850, when the state was established, through to today due to discrimination. Whatever the final figures, it's unclear how California would afford to pay millions of dollars to each eligible black resident of the state. California Governor Gavin Newsom announced in January that the state faces a projected budget deficit of $22.5 billion for the coming fiscal year. Just weeks later, the California Legislative Analyst Office, a government agency that analyzes the budget for the state legislature, estimated in a subsequent report that Gavin Newsom's forecast undershot the mark by about $7 billion.
Economic Divide.
The U.S. debt ceiling has turned into a crisis again. This could be a partisan issue, which most likely it is. But at the same time, what is the U.S. doing when it comes to bringing this to the last minute and pushing the envelope? That's going to be the topic of this edition of the program. Coming up in today's program, these are some of the highlights that we'll be covering. First, when it comes to the U.S. debt ceiling and how that is panning out. Well, it's a bipartisan issue. We're going to explore that. Government shutdown is one of the consequences that may happen. And that, as a result, would be a risk to all Americans, okay? So that's how serious this is when it comes to the debt ceiling. Now, there have been, when it comes to debt ceiling, there have been previous debt ceiling increases in the U.S. on multiple occasions. However, this time around, we're looking at $31.4 trillion for the year 2023. A quick question that comes about here, which we'll explore, is payback even possible? Then we'll take a look at the actual debt. The U.S. national debt is an epic figure. And by some accounts, even military personnel have said it's a threat to U.S. national security, and it risks a default. Will that happen?
House of Representatives has passed a bill that would boost the U.S.'s $31.4 trillion Fed debt ceiling in exchange for slashing government spending, including programs championed by the Democratic President Joe Biden, passed by a party-line vote of 217 to 215, with four Republicans breaking ranks. The bill now heads to the Democrat-controlled Senate, where it stands little chance of passing. Biden has already threatened to veto the bill, which includes spending cuts that he previously called irresponsible.
We've done our job. I've sat down with the president on February 1st. He ignored the rest of the time. He treats it just like the border. He wants to ignore it and thinks it goes away. That doesn't work in America. He's putting the American economy in jeopardy by his lack of action. Now he should sit down and negotiate. We passed this early. We are in April. way ahead of the debt limit. We are the only party to take fiscal action in a sound mind that would lift the debt limit so we wouldn't have economic damage.
The U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has warned that the failure by Congress to raise the government's debt ceiling and the resulting default would trigger an economic catastrophe. The debt ceiling, also known as the debt limit, is the amount the U.S. can legally borrow to fulfill its financial obligations. When it comes to the U.S. national debt, the debt ceiling has been increased multiple times, the most recent one to have been risen to $31.4 trillion in December 2021. A failure to raise the limit would see the U.S. default. Lifting the debt ceiling was once a fairly routine vote. Since 1960, Congress has raised the ceiling 78 times, 49 times under Republican presidents, and 29 times under Democratic presidents. The debt ceiling was last raised in 2021 to $31.4 trillion, where it currently stands. Big increases in recent years have come not only from spending to combat COVID-19 and on the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, but also to cover the rising medical costs of an aging population and to fund all other services that government provides. The U.S. national debt has reached such epic proportions that it is said to be the biggest threat to U.S. national security. At the same time, one of the biggest U.S. spending is on its military, which is more than the next 9 top spending countries combined. Financial markets are growing increasingly concerned about the standoff, sending the cost of insuring exposure to U.S. debt to its highest level in a decade, with financial analysts warning about the increasing risk of a default.
It's time now for the social media post on this program. There was a lot of bickering when it came on this topic, taking a look at the posts that we were perusing through. Anyways, first up, as total debt surpasses $31.4 trillion, the current statutory limit, the Treasury is undertaking a series of bookkeeping maneuvers to disguise new borrowing and to keep the government operating. Next, this person said, I can't believe I'm writing this, but the U.S. Treasury will be in the market borrowing $207 billion today, of which it listed some items like $60 billion of 44-day cash management bills or $70 billion of 4-week T-bills. Obviously, a lot of borrowing going on there, taking a look at this list. We then go to a website, the fake fight over the debt ceiling was the title. The debt ceiling forces us to talk about the proper role of government, but nobody wants to do that. We figure we'll break this down further. Democrats, of course, are not even pretending to rein in government and simply propose new spending. And then it says, that's a big problem because our $31 trillion national debt has reached unprecedented levels and does need to be limited and then reduced. Next, we go to this post where it says, the debt ceiling, America's budget crisis of its own creation. The dispute over U.S. national debt is not one of economics, but of gridlocked partisan politics. All right, those were some of the social media posts there. Let me introduce our guest for this first segment of our Q&A. First, we're going to bring in Martin Saif. He's a former managing editor and at International Affairs and a former chief news analyst at United Press International. Martin Saif, welcome to Economic Divide. This is a common scenario when it comes to the debt ceiling and the showdown that basically it seems like it's a showdown between the parties. Republicans have refused to increase the U.S. debt ceiling, and that's a limit on the amount of money Washington can borrow. And you need, obviously, to have the U.S. president to consent to the large spending cuts, which, obviously, he has so far rejected. But then at the end, you always get this increase one way or another. At least that's what history has proven. Why does the U.S. find itself in this position time and again?
I think the ultimate reason, unfortunately, is that we have a 1789 constitution, a constitution that is now almost a quarter of a millennium old, and we have not adapted it for the 21st century. And in American society today, that atmosphere of bipartisanship and statesmanship is breaking down. And that is the real problem. It is breaking down. You have to have cooperation to make the system work. And the cooperation is not there, certainly on the Republican side at the moment.
Okay, let's bring in now Richard Black. Richard Black is the former state senator of Virginia, and he's also a Republican politician. Richard Black, welcome to Economic Divide. You know, taking a look at this debt ceiling, I don't want to say debacle, but it really it should be very simple. You have a budget that gets passed, voted on, and if you go, you have to act and spend according to that budget. But time and again, the U.S. President or its administration goes beyond that or reaches that limit. It sounds like there's not only oversight, but obviously there is, but by design, it's moving forward that way. What if the U.S. can't pay this huge debt of over $31 trillion? And what would be the impact on the U.S. economy?
Well, it's a very difficult issue. There really are two primary points. One is that the United States dollar is the world's reserve currency. Because so much of the world's trade is settled in dollars, it makes it somewhat of an essential currency, at least for the time being. It may not retain that status, but as long as it does, the United States can literally create $1 trillion out of thin air. Now, that can only go on for so long, but it may still be quite a while before that ends. Now, the other part of the question you asked deals with, you know, does it ever reach a point where it simply can't be paid? The more that you accumulate debt without having real production to back it up, the more seductive this becomes, and you see this constant ratcheting up and increase in debt. And right now the debt is very, very high, and that exposes us to risks of inflation, and it also puts pressure on the world's economy.
Time now for the Info News section of the program. As usual, we have picked four topics for you with an economic flavor. First up, we take a look at UK's economy. We've taken a look at UK's economy quite a bit in the past 6 months. But this one, we had to bring to you because it's quite unbelievable. This is what the Bank of England has said, which is quite harsh, the message that it had for the Brits. It said that Britons need to accept that they are poor. That's what they have said. This is while UK's finance minister has said this was a very difficult period, as prices of items like milk, sugar, and olive oil were around 40% higher than a year ago.
We understand the pressure that everyone is facing as a result of the increase in food prices, for example, that we see today. But the one thing they would not want us to do is to take a decision on pay that means that we entrench high inflation and we're still having these same bitter arguments in a year's time.
Next up, Russia-Iran de-dollarization. The next topic is just that, something we focused on quite a bit. Again, some of these news items need to be reintroduced in order to see what's going on with the latest. Here, Iran and Russia, they're taking the last steps toward integrating their economic banking systems. Iran's Shatab and Russia's Mir networks, these are the financial payment systems, they have started their joint financial activities on a trial basis. Really looking forward to seeing how that is going to pan out. All right, sanctions is up next in terms of anti-Russia sanctions that the West has executed against Russia. The Russian finance minister has said that these Western sanctions, they have actually boomeranged. That is said quite a bit when it comes to sanctions. And, of course, Russia and Iran have been at the receiving end. The EU's short-sighted policy is hurting the bloc more than Moscow. And he went on to say Western restrictions have diminished global confidence in the U.S. dollar and also the euro, adding, when Western countries introduce new packages of restrictions, we take anti-sanctions measures, and we see that we are succeeding. Finally, look at Israel's economy and see how they're doing with the protests that are still going strong after, we've lost count here. I think it's 4 months now that people there in the occupied territories are coming out and protesting against Netanyahu and his so-called judicial reforms. Moody's credit rating agency has cut Israel's sovereign credit rating, lowering Israel's outlook to stable from positive. It said the planned reforms could weaken Israel's institutions. The Israeli finance minister, however, had another take on it.
אם עלולה להיות פגיעה בכלכלה, ואגב, אני לא מאמין שתהיה פגיעה בכלכלה, אבל אם עלולה להיות פגיעה בכלכלה, זה בגלל כל מיני קמפיינים של שקרים ותבהלות וניציון אפילו מכוון לייצר סנטימנט שלילי בכלכלה כתוצאה מזה.
All right, those were the topics that we picked.
Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
The in-depth section is upon us. The U.S. government has hit its $31.4 trillion debt ceiling. That has triggered fears of a nasty fallout for Americans. Well, here are some of the facts in this in-depth section behind the debt ceiling crisis. First up, as the national debt has soared, the U.S. Treasury Department has had to borrow more money to pay for government spending. That's the definition of it. The legislative curb on this borrowing is known as the debt ceiling. National debt soaring is another way of describing government spending. Then we move on to what the Treasury Department does in terms of spending. Well, it spends the maximum amount authorized under the ceiling, but Congress must decide to suspend or to raise the limit on borrowing. All right. Now, here's a look at how, irrespective of who's been in the White House, the U.S. debt has increased dramatically as you progress from the year 1981 all the way through the year 2022. No matter who's been in office, the debt ceiling has increased. Let's move on to the next total national debt. And the debt ceiling, we've mentioned this figure before, September 2021, where the debt went, where it was at $28.5 trillion. It went all the way up to almost $31.5 trillion, which is where we stand. And that is where, obviously, the U.S. public debt is subject to its limit. All right, the next graph, a Moody's analysis, is what we're going to look at, which said that GOP spending cuts and a debt ceiling increase and the repercussions of it. Well, 2.6 million jobs. Okay, that's a lot. Loss per day, $300 million. GDP loss, 0.3% of the U.S.'s GDP. Layoffs, now these are federal work layoffs, federal workers, 1 million, okay? And then you have one of the most important ones that could be impacted or will be impacted, and that's military staff salaries that are not going to get paid, and obviously that's going to affect the U.S.'s security, okay? So how serious of an issue this is. Then we move on to how the U.S. government has run a deficit. This is important because, again, why do they keep going above what they have to spend? How much money are we talking about? It's $1 trillion on average that the government spends more based on the budget that they pass. It's not just a matter of $100 million or $50 million, $1 trillion more. And obviously that's something that has been going on, but some say it's not sustainable, and it means that they spend more money than they receive in taxes and other revenue. And to make up the difference, needs to continue to borrow. That's right, you guessed it right. Let's find out what our guests think. Martin Safe rejoins us. He's a former managing editor at International Affairs, also a former chief news analyst at United Press International. All right, Martin Safe, welcome back to Economic Divide. When you take a look at how the U.S. national debt has increased multiple times over the, obviously, years and decades, really, the most recent one, $31.4 trillion, December 2021 or January 2022. Hasn't the U.S. debt reached a point, the question being that the figure is so high that, you know, can they ever pay it back? I mean, what if it defaults? What would be the impact on the U.S. economy, do you think?
If there is a default, it will be for the first time in U.S. history. It will be devastating to America's credibility in the world. It will probably cause a crash on Wall Street, such as we have not seen in almost a century since 1929. The results would be catastrophic. And it would throw the American economy and American society into chaos. And privately, a lot of Republicans realize this, but publicly they are cowards, and the Republicans are not certain they can defeat him in 2024. So they want to discredit him politically, and they also believe that if there is an economic recession, even if their policies cause it before 2024, they can blame the president and the Democrats as the party in office for that happening. So it's a very risky and irresponsible policy. It is not a national policy. It is not a patriotic policy in U.S. terms, but they wanted to simply get back into power.
All right. Thank you for that, Martin Safe. Let's bring back Richard Black, former state senator of Virginia and Republican politician. Richard Black, welcome back to Economic Divide. The U.S. national debt, it has reached such epic proportions. We need to have you put things into perspective for us, because on the one hand, you have not only economists, but also more importantly, you have some army officials saying that that's the biggest threat to U.S. national security. At the same time, you have the U.S. that spends so much on its military, more than the next nine top spending countries combined. Can you please put that into perspective for us?
Yes, the United States military budget is gargantuan. We have a budget that is 12 times as much as Russia's military budget. Right now, the U.S. spends three times as much as China. Our military presence across the globe is clearly excessive. What are we doing in the Middle East? Why do we have troops in the Middle East? We didn't have that when I was a colonel in the Pentagon. Things were very calm and peaceful over there, and since then, we've had enormous military engagements there.
If lawmakers don't raise the nation's borrowing limit by June, the federal government runs the risk of defaulting on its debt obligation. That would be catastrophic for the economy, which would put millions of jobs in jeopardy. Investors are demanding historically high yields for U.S. Treasury notes that mature in July. That is when the U.S. will default on its debt if no legislative action is taken. When yields on shorter-term bonds exceed those of longer-term bonds, it's often a sign that bad economic times are ahead.
On one hand, it looks like the Fed can continue raising rates, or at least raise 25 bips in May, which is what the market is expecting, and that's where the consensus view is. On the other hand, of course, we have this banking crisis, which is causing stress in the financial system, and we are seeing signals that credit may be tightening. So I think what is most likely to happen is that the Fed is going to raise this 25 bips, because that's also what they have been communicating for a while indirectly. And then they're likely to pause and see how the inflation evolves, and whether we get the kind of decline in inflation that is expected, that the Fed is expecting. I think the big disconnect right now in the market is that how long the Fed stays at current levels and how soon they are going to cut interest rates. And I think to that extent, what the Fed is saying, that no cuts in 2023 and stay at current high levels. Where
the last prolonged standoff over the debt limit in 2011 led to a downgrade of the U.S. credit rating, which shook financial markets and raised borrowing costs. Some Republicans say the current bill does not do enough to cut the deficit. In 2011, a debt ceiling standoff led to credit rating agency Standard & Poor's downgrade of U.S. debt from the highest possible status, AAA, to AA+. During the last fiscal year, the federal government spent more on interest payments than transportation, housing or food, and nutrition services combined. In the final quarter of 2022, paid a record $213 billion in interest, up from $63 billion during the same period from the year before. It now seems that the U.S. debt has reached a point that it can never pay it back.